So this is Craig Young interviewing Doug Hudson, who was flying with the number 6 group in the 420 squadron, fought in World War II. So, Doug, could you tell me, why was the 420 squadron part of the Ontario group? Why was it?
Well, it was part of 6 group.
Or, sorry, yeah. You said it was recognized by Ontario?
It was adopted by the City of London, Ontario.
Okay.
And they used to send us, for instance, boxes of oranges and at Christmas time and so forth.
Oh, okay.
And all the squadrons were always adopted by, for instance, the Porcupine Squadron was adopted by Porcupine Mines.
Okay.
That sort of thing.
Yeah.
That's the connection. And we got boxes of oranges for Christmas. They got pajamas.
Okay. So, can you explain to me, tell the story once again about how you enlisted into the RCAF?
Oh, yeah. Well, I lived on a farm east of Winnipeg, 15 miles. Now the Winnipeg is part of the town. I went to town to join the Navy. And to get to the Navy HMCS Chippewa, I had to walk down Main Street. And I'm walking down Main Street to get to Ellis Avenue. And I looked up and I said, RCAF recruiting. And I did a left turn, went in. And I said to the chap at the desk, can I get an air crew? And he said, sit down and sign here. So that's how I got into air crew instead of the Navy. And my education limited me to a wireless air gunner as opposed to navigator or pilot. So I became a wireless air gunner, and I never touched a gun. I was strictly wireless operator. In those days, they called it wireless as opposed to radio. And so I went to wireless school. And wireless school is like learning another language. And you repeat and repeat and repeat until you recognize things in your sleep. And when we got on to our flying, we left the wireless school and did flying. They had a portion of the school was flying, and that's where we learned to operate in the air. And we graduated from that then, and we were at our wings as wireless air gunners.
And so where did the trainings take place?
In Winnipeg.
In Winnipeg?
In number three wireless school, Winnipeg.
And how old were you at the time?
21. I didn't join until I was 21 because I waited till my sister was 16 so she could work with my father on the farm, drive the tractor and so forth. And so the day she became 16, I left home and joined the Air Force, or went to join the Navy. Joined the Air Force. And then I went to Lachine, Quebec to do my boot camp, basic training. And then back to Winnipeg to take my wireless training.
And this
at number three wireless school.
Okay. And this was 1941 then? Or 42.
42.
Okay.
42 and 43.
42 and 43?
It'd take about a year to turn out a radio operator.
Okay.
Wireless operator.
Okay. And how did you find the training? Was it sufficient training?
Oh, yeah. It was adequate. It was very well done, really. And good instructors, although they were frustrated in the job. You know, they wanted to be overseas.
Mm-hmm.
But they were... They were kept in these training positions and instructing. It was hour after hour after hour of wireless key training. You know, it was like learning another language. And then it became automatic. You just, you know, when you were on a streetcar going downtown, you were repeating all the signs in Morse code to yourself, learning it, you know.
Right.
Just a repetition.
Right.
Continuous.
And did you receive any more, like, advanced training for the gunnery aspect of the job?
No.
No?
We went, when we got overseas, we went to advanced flying schools where they were training with advanced flying for navigators on the Irish Sea. And we flew in Mark 1 Ensigns. And it was also training for us over the North Sea, doing square searches for downed aircraft, Mark 1 Ensigns. And then from there, we went to Operational Training Unit, OTU, where they put all trades, it was a base with all trades in it. And that's where you crewed up. That's where you joined your crew.
Okay.
And I didn't crew up, I didn't push it. I just stayed back. And I was approached by a pilot and a navigator. And inquiring was I crewed up yet? And I said no, and I was the last one. And they said, well, we're looking for a wag. I said, okay. They look like a couple of good guys. So I went with them. And we became an excellent crew. Then we picked up a couple of gunners, plus a flight engineer, and became a crew. An excellent crew, in that we had absolute trust in each other. Absolute confidence and trust in each other. That makes for a good crew. And we started. Our first stop was to a place called Bochum in Germany. We completed 32 missions.
So that's just over a full tour?
Yeah. 30 was a tour. But when we had 28 in, and we never discussed how many trips we had in. We never, amongst ourselves, never trusted, said, well, when we had 28 in, we said, we didn't say to each other, we got two more to go. We didn't touch that subject at all. And when we had 28 in, they upped it to 35, because it was towards the end of the war. And they had lots of aircrew on stream. But there was no point in putting them through a further OTU, for instance, when all we had to do was a few more. And so they could stop the training stream. So, and we were in the briefing room preparing for another raid where we had 32 in, and they said, anybody with 30 or more trips in is finished. So that's how we got screened. Call it screening.
Yeah.
When you're finished. So we were screened at 32 as opposed to 30 when we were. They had slated the crews to do 35. It would preclude bringing fresh crews online and further training. So they stopped all the training. And we did five more, although we only did two. We had two in when they canceled. They screened us.
Mm-hmm. So in what year would that have been?
45.
That was in 45, so it's right near the end there.
May of 45.
How was the morale in your unit and your crew?
Excellent.
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 Would it ever go up and down, or were you guys all?
No, we had complete trust in each other. If we got hit, well, you know, nothing you can do about it, because there was aircraft blowing up all, you know, getting hit and blowing up in the air. And if you got hit, you got hit, that's all, and nothing you could do about it. But in the meantime, you had absolute trust in each other and confidence in their abilities.
Right. So were you guys together the whole time, and nobody got hit?
No. Oh, the tail gun, the mid-upper gunner, he got into trouble, and he disappeared. And we never saw him again. I don't know what happened to him. We have no idea what happened to him. So we flew with spares, one spare gunner, because there was always spares. There was always gunners available. There was always extra gunners.
Right. So was this during a night mission when this happened?
Well, no, it was between missions. He just disappeared.
Oh, okay.
I don't know where he went.
He just looked, okay.
He'd so done something, and he disappeared. You know, he didn't have to do much to get into trouble. I mean, he was a bit of a wild man anyway. So we flew with spare gunners then. Now, when we flew an aircraft without H2S, that's the radar, then there was a mid lower gunner directly underneath the aircraft, and he was in this cockpit, and his feet were up like this, and he was looking straight down. And he was just strapped in, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And he got in from the outside of the aircraft.
Right.
Lifted himself up in, and then connected with the rest of the crew with the intercom. Now, if we were crash landing, belly landing, we had to get him out because he couldn't come up in the aircraft.
Right.
We had to contact him and get him out and make sure that he got out before we squashed him on a belly landing.
Right.
So that had to be done.
So there was an instance when you guys did do a belly landing then?
No, we never had to.
Oh, you never had to?
Never had to, no.
And what planes were you flying? Was that, you had the Halifaxes?
Halifax 3s.
Halifax
3s. Inline engines. Oh, pardon me, radial engines.
So was anybody in your squadron, did they get any of the Lancasters? Or?
No, the Lancasters came after, at the end of the war.
Yeah.
The Canadian group, the 6th group, transferred to Lancasters. They were Canadian-built Lancs, and they were flown over to replace the Halifaxes. And of course, then the war quit.
Mm-hmm.
The war was over, so the Lancasters were all flown back to Canada because they were Canadian-built.
Did you feel the Halifaxes were a solid airplane? You felt safe in them?
Oh, absolutely. There's lots of room in them.
Yeah.
For instance, yeah. one time we got a 1,000-pounder hang-up. 1,000-pound bomb we couldn't get rid of.
Oh, yeah.
It was a hang-up. We couldn't drop them over occupied territories, for instance, Holland and Belgium. We could drop them over Germany if you could get rid of them. But we had this hang-up, a 1,000-pounder, And we couldn't get rid of it over Germany, so they, and we couldn't drop it over the Belgium and Holland. But there was a disposal barrier out in the North Sea where you could dispose of it. When we got out there, we still couldn't get rid of it. And the gunners said there's a Focke-Wulf 190 stooging around, German fighter. I said, let's get the hell out of here. So we still had to hang up, but we left the disposal area, the jettison area, and headed for, on the east coast of England, was an emergency landing field. It was a runway, three runways wide and 3 miles long for cripples to get in. So we had it there with the hang-up. And we gathered in all our, we gathered in the crash positions and then took our positions in the crash positions and then waited for the touchdown. And we didn't know whether this bloody thing would blow on touchdown or any jar or hard landing, would it go off? Because it was fused and selected.
Right.
And so all the crew except the pilot and the engineer stayed in their positions, and the rest of us took the crash positions and huddled down waiting for the touchdown. And we touched down on this emergency field and rolled to a lost speed, and the pilot pulled off on the grass.
Yeah.
And then we all jumped out and ran like hell. And the pilot said he was running as hard as he bloody well could. He said, the tail gunner passed me like I'm standing still. So we all, on this emergency field, I don't suppose the mess ever closed. Anyway, we ate, had a meal, and went to bed. And got up the next morning and walked out to where we'd left the aircraft. The aircraft was sitting there, and the bomb was sitting. The bomb disposal people had removed the bomb, 1,000-pounder, and it was laying there beside the airplane. We took off and went back to our base. And we were diverted 9 times of the 30-some-odd trips that we made. 9 of them where we didn't get back to base due to weather, flak damage, fuel, lack of fuel, and so 9 times we didn't sleep in our beds, but at least it was in England.
You always made it back to England.
Yeah, I always made it back to England.
Right.
And of course, you know, you're flying without lights, and always at night. And the flight engineer had a cupola up on the top of the aircraft that he could stand up in there and see around. And he said he saw a black thing go by us, and it was another Lank or another Halifax. It was that close. He said, I ducked because I thought it was that close. These are stories. But we always made it back to England, back at least to emergency drones or diversions. Because we were up flying out of sixth group was in up in Yorkshire. So we had the farthest to go of any of the groups, plus the worst weather because we were farther north in England. So we had winter. And speaking of snow, we were given this runway, and in the meantime, the right hand, not knowing what the left hand was doing, they plowed this way. So they left snowbanks on the runway in use. And we hit this bloody snowbank, and the pilot then it threw us off. We were heading across the field, just clearing the ground. The pilot lifted the wheels so that we got a little more space anyway. And we were heading towards the maintenance hangar. Beside the maintenance hangar was the crew shack. It was full of the ground crew. And they heard us coming, and it must have sounded like we were coming right in the door. The door flew open, and it started spewing people. They all bailed out of this crew shack.
They thought you were coming right for them?
Yeah. Now, on takeoff, we had an aircraft that blew up on occasion. And for one reason or another, they blew up. And we used to go down to the little pub close by where the farmers hung out. Farmers was with a village pub. And just not long before, we had one of these, we had an aircraft blow up just on takeoff over the pub and the farms and so forth. Oh, no, it blew up over barns. Anyway, it wrecked all the barns. And in the pub the following weekend, the farmers were in there and we were in there. And the farmers were raising hell about these bloody airplanes blowing up over their barns. Little did they realize there was 7 guys in that bloody airplane that got blown up with it.
Right.
And they were complaining, and of course we were on the opposite side of the street, and we didn't appreciate their comments about the bloody airplanes blowing up over their property.
Right. Mm. Well, that's understandable.
Yeah, right.
So did you guys not get along with the locals too well then?
No. That was a local pub, and we used to go there. And my pilot had been a choir boy. An altar boy at the Christ Church Cathedral here in Victoria.
Okay.
And so he became close friends with our padre, who was an Anglican, by the way. And he used to go drinking with us, and he'd get plastered. And it was all great fun. Anyway, they had a... The windows in the pub were open from the top down. There was about this much space at the top of the windows. And the padre would throw the empty bottles out through this open window. And he never missed. No matter how drunk he got. Oh, dear me.
That's funny. When you guys were flying your missions, you said all the missions took place at night?
We had a couple of towards the end of the war, we had a couple of daylights in the Hawkwall Forest. The Canadian Army was approaching the Hawkwall Forest, and we were told, we were briefed that if the army had moved up you know, if they got ahead of themselves, ahead of their timing, as they did in Caen, we bombed our own troops there. Mm-hmm. Because the army moved up ahead and we weren't briefed. So this time, when they were moving up into the Cotswold Forest, by the time we got there, they could be there too. And so they had a code word, basement. If you hear the word basement, close your bomb doors and take off. And we had our bomb doors open and we were ready to drop the bombs. And we heard basement. It meant the army was in there. Now, so then we just closed the doors and took off.
Right.
So that was close.
Good communication then.
Well, yeah. Yeah. Whereas in Caen there was no communication, and my brother-in-law was there. He was in one of the Manitoba regiments, in the Manitoba Dragoons, and he got plastered. His driver was killed when the Canadians dropped the bombs. We never got on good terms with the Canadian Army again, as far as I know. But it nearly happened again in Cotswold Forest. It was close.
Right.
Bomb doors were open.
Were you flying on like the Caen mission as well, or no?
Was it what?
Were you flying over during that Caen mission?
Yes, I was there.
Yeah.
I was there.
Yeah.
So when I heard the term basement, and you close your bomb doors and took off.
Right.
And then that's where you got rid of your bombs, in this disposal area in the North Sea. So you didn't have to land with them.
And what year was this?
1945.
Towards the end of the war. So when you were flying your missions, were you guys staggered in your formation, or?
We didn't fly formation. We flew what? But well, we flew at night mainly.
Mm-hmm.
But if we flew during the day, we flew in what was called a gaggle, because we weren't trained to fly formation. Americans flew formation because they flew during the day, and we flew for it during the night. And we all had our own navigators, so we. Be quiet. We flew. What was I going to say?
You flew in the gaggle.
Yeah, I flew in a gaggle. And we practiced it. We were just a bunch of aircraft flying in a gaggle. That was the term. But it wasn't formation. We were all on our own with our own navigators and so forth. But you could see the aircraft around you in the gaggle.
Right.
The Americans shake their heads at that.
They didn't quite get it, huh?
No. That's a formation.
Did you see it more of an advantage in this? Do you think it was safer at flying at night then?
Yeah, well, I think so. Because the Americans, you know, they couldn't break formation. So the Germans would just shoot to fill that part of the sky with ack-ack, and they took a hell of a beating.
Mm-hmm.
We landed at we were diverted to American base one time, and we were there when they came, and we got there just about daylight when they were taking off. Then we were still there when they came back, and they carried no end of wounded men out of the fortresses and dead men. They just had to take it because the Germans had fill the air with ack-ack and aircraft.
Right.
And so we were shaking our heads at that, but they were shaking their heads at us too when we were flying in gaggles.
So you guys could take evasive actions,
well,
and
we
dive?
Yes, of course.
Move all around when the Americans couldn't.
And We took violent evasive action. You know, violent evasive action. I don't know how those Halifaxes stayed together, you know, when the pilot went into evasive action to evade fighters at night. And the Germans, they had upward-firing guns, too, on their aircraft. They'd fly underneath us with these upward-firing guns and rake our bellies.
Right. Those were, what, the Messerschmitt 110? Is that
yeah,
the ones
yeah,
that had them?
Yeah, 110s. Or Focke-Wulf 190s.
Yeah. Did you feel that the guns and the weapons on your on the Halifaxes were sufficient in protecting against enemy fighters?
Oh, yeah, we had 303s. We didn't have any .5s. All 303s. We had four 303s in the tail. Four 303s in the mid-upper. And a VGO 303 Vickers gas operated in the nose. Plus, when we had these pods under the belly, the gunner in there had a 0.5 millimeter in between his legs shooting down.
Right.